The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. As the statue of Winston Churchill is boarded up in a box ahead of potential protests this weekend, the Prime Minister has taken to social media to explain his views on statues and why they should be protected. James, what did Boris Johnson have to say?
He argues that, rightly, that Churchill is a kind of national hero, he shouldn't be boxed up. And he also, I think, makes the point that you can't try and edit history. You can't go through and pretend that Britain was not the country that it was. And I think trying to kind of impose a kind of simplistic narrative on the past is a mistake and is doomed to fail. And I think it doesn't matter what the statue is built for. The statue of Churchill in Parliament Square is to recognise that he was the Prime Minister of this country, and if he had not been the Prime Minister of this country, Britain might well not have carried on fighting in 1940. You know, I mean, everyone should read John Lukacs's 5 Days in May to realise what a close-run thing that decision was. No one is putting that up there to celebrate Churchill's kind of outdated views on race. It's about World War II and that moment in our history, and if we can't salute and acknowledge that moment in our history, what can we?
Fraser, when you see what's happened this morning, I mean, a lot of people are voicing discomfort that we are at a point where a box has to be put around the statue for its protection. What do you make of the decision to do that?
In a way, I think the government is having a swipe at the protesters, actually, saying, look, what a bunch of thugs they are that we have to do this. I walked past the statue this morning on the way to work. It's pretty strange. They're also, as far as I can work out, going to put a box around the statues of Gandhi and Mandela as well. So it's not just Churchill. I'm also struck by the way that Boris Johnson is now saying the sorts of things people wanted him to say after the protests and after the statues were defaced in the first place. What he's said has been very eloquent. We can't try to edit or censor our past, he's saying. To tear down the statues would be to lie about our history and impoverish the education of generations to come. This is all true, but it was also true on Monday after the statues had been torn down in the first place. So I think the government is now finding its confidence and finding its narrative. It's decided it wants to go after the protesters. It's talking about putting them in jail within 24 hours if they've been found to be guilty. And I think it has worked out that the protests underlined a general sense in Britain that the government wasn't really in control. And in fact, the scenes in Bristol made you wonder if anybody really was in control. I think we're trying to restore order, and boxing up the statues is the first part of that. And by the way, I don't think that the protesters, I would suggest that only less than 0.1% of them would think it was okay to deface a Churchill statue. And in a way, this gesture almost makes out that all of them are out to topple Churchill. I don't think that was the case. But I think the boxing up of the statue sends itself quite a powerful message.
Just on that briefly, Fraser, when it comes to, as you say, the protests, which began in response to the death of George Floyd in America, it has felt as though, as the week has gone on, Conservative politicians have become more confident about what they want to say in this debate. And I think one turning point was when Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, spoke in the chamber, and when the conversation moved from what had happened to in America to institutional racism in the UK. She gave a personal account of the experiences she has faced. Now, yesterday, a group of Labour MPs, they themselves are members of the BAME community, wrote to her and suggested that in doing this, she was potentially gaslighting other ethnic minorities. This is something you write about in your Telegraph column today.
Yeah, I think it's quite an extraordinary moment, actually, because Boris Johnson appointed more BAME people to his cabinet than all prime ministers before him put together. And the people he has promoted have got one thing in common. They hate the phrase BAME. Priti Patel actually tells her civil servants not to use it because she regards it as pointless and arguably racist. And you can see her points, because the gap, for example, between the attainments of school attainments of Indians and Pakistanis is bigger than the gap between black and white. The diversity within these ethnic groups is huge in Britain. The same is true, by the way, even the phrase black aligns the difference between black African and black Caribbean, who perform very differently in school and in earnings. So the phrase isn't useful as a policy tool, but more importantly, we're seeing here Labour take a very different approach to race relations than the Tories. Labour see this huge energy behind the Black Lives Matter protest, and they're sort of wondering if they can harness this and apply this white versus BAME or non-white narrative to politics. But the problem is, when they do this, you've got a Ugandan Asian Home Secretary and you've got a Chancellor of Indian Heritage, and this frustrates them a little bit. So it's almost as if they're saying that the Indians are somehow too privileged to have experience or knowledge of the problems that black Brits have suffered. So you're getting into very strange territory, which I find certainly rather unpalatable and borderline racist in parts. So it'd be very interesting to see how this plays out. But also, interestingly, the fight back hasn't come from number 10. It's come from people like Kemi Badenoch, the Equalities Minister, Priti Patel, the Home Secretary. They've got together and they've said, we are not going to let Labour box us into a BAME corner. We reject these labels. We reject identity politics. And you can now see a Tory fight back against identity politics, which is being used by big chunks of the Labour Party.
Now, the big economic news today relates to new figures from the ONS, which show that in April, British GDP fell by over 20%. James, this is obviously a huge figure. Can you put it into a historical context for us of what we are currently witnessing?
Well, it is the worst ever monthly performance in history. I think it tells you what happens when you basically put the entire economy into a kind of induced coma, as the kind of lockdown did. I think that the fall in GDP is not a surprise. The question is what kind of recovery we are in for. And, you know, I think there was some optimism at the beginning that it might be V-shaped. Then the hope was that it would be at least U-shaped. And now I think there is a lot of worry that you know, maybe it's going to be more of an L than a U. And I think that worry has been fueled by the fact that the number of cases in the US, the world's largest economy, seems to be on the rise again. And I think one of the big uncertainties hanging over the economy is what is going to happen this winter. You heard it at the Downing Street press conference on Wednesday when Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, was talking about how the virus will have advantages in winter, but it doesn't have now. And I think this is the big question, which is, you know, is this uncertainty about what is going to happen in the winter going to hang over the economy, meaning that consumers don't want to go out and spend money because they want to be prepared in case there is another slowdown in the economy? Businesses want to hold off investment for that reason. You know, I think that is difficult. And I think this obviously also has obvious implications for employment, because if you look at why there was such a jobs miracle in the past decade, it was heavily driven by retail and hospitality. Those are the two sectors of the economy most affected by coronavirus.
Fraser, when we're looking at the recovery, one of the big issues right now is the 2 metre rule. I think Tory MP see it as critical to getting hospitality back in some form this summer, retail going in some form, and potentially also helping the schools return. So do you have much hope? Because there's indications the Chancellor wants it to be moved. Boris Johnson sounds sympathetic, but wants scientific data that he can use in a way to back it. But Sage is reluctant right now. Ultimately, it's a political decision, though. So do you think this is imminent, or are we going to keep seeing caution from number 10?
I'm afraid I don't think it's imminent. So when you hear Boris Johnson saying he's looking for scientific data, you know he's not going to find it, because it just simply doesn't exist. In the leading article of the magazine this week, we say that he needs to take back control from the Sage Committee and make political judgments. You're not going to get a scientific proof that, you know, that 1 metre is far safer or is okay and 2 metres is not okay. You're going to have to take a judgment based on what is happening all around the world. And we know that there's going to be, you know, most shops are going to reopen or be allowed to reopen next week. So you have the bizarre and frankly appalling spectacle of 18-year-olds allowed to go to the pub beer garden, but not entitled to go to a classroom. And I'm afraid to say, you can't hide behind scientists on this. This is entirely a political decision. But we are seeing, as we're seeing almost every week, the consequence of a government whose confidence has been shot by the failure of lockdown to achieve what they hoped to achieve, and that was to keep the deaths to below 20,000. When we're looking at a figure between 40 and 60,000, you're also looking at a number 10 that's scared of its own shadow on this stuff. So if you want to know what's going to happen in Britain, just look at the rest of Europe and think, if we're lucky, we'll be there in 3 weeks' time.
James, new polling out today suggests that someone could be benefiting from the government's problems right now, and that is the Labour leader Keir Starmer. A new Ipsos Mori poll says he has the best net satisfaction scores for a leader of the opposition since Tony Blair. Is this something that's going to worry Downing Street? We are still fairly early in terms of the parliament.
Yeah, we're still early in the electoral cycle, and the Tories are still ahead in voting intention. But I think what this polling shows is something important. At the last election, the Tories were undoubtedly buoyed by the fact that lots of voters just couldn't imagine and couldn't think it was responsible to have Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. That clearly does not apply to Keir Starmer. He is not a drag on Labour's ratings in the way that Jeremy Corbyn was. I think Keir Starmer has also worked out something clever, which is that, you know, in Britain, it tends to be that governments lose elections rather than oppositions win them. So he's not making himself a big target. He's been very steady as she goes. One of the raps on Keir Starmer is that, you know, he's dull. He's not exactly the most charismatic or magnetic politician. But actually, I think there is a chance that could become a strength for him. That after all the political upheaval of the last few years and coronavirus, that, you know, that dullness begins to seem rather appealing.
Fraser, have you been impressed by Keir Starmer so far? He seems to be taking a more moderate path than some in his party would like, but the initial polling, and obviously all polling should be taken with some scepticism, does suggest that it is yielding results.
Yeah, I would say that polls are almost borderline irrelevant at the moment. What will matter is a build-up of credibility, and we are at least 4 years away from the next general election. But I have been impressed at the way that he has been more forensic in his approach. He has used his job as leader of the opposition to oppose the government. I mean, that kind of sounds tautological, but Jeremy Corbyn often used it as a kind of an ideological safe space and to say things that made him and his supporters feel good but weren't going to win power. I'm pleased to see that the government's getting more opposition at the moment because I think it certainly needs it. I've also been encouraged to see him keep a distance from the wilder factions in his party. I mean, for example, Katie, we were talking earlier about this letter signed by 33 Labour MPs advancing basically identity politics and using it to attack the Conservatives. Keir Starmer seems to be taking a step back from that, sensing, I think rightly, that there might not be many votes in that particular way of seeing the country, and that Labour might want to be a party that emphasises social cohesion rather than ethnic sectarian conflict. So it does seem to me as if he's taking a more moderate and, I suspect, longer term, more effective role. But for the time being, I think the biggest potential opponent to Boris Johnson remains Boris Johnson. If he doesn't manage to, I think, steady his government from the almighty wobble which is having right now, then that will have far more long-term effects.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.